everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. If we do not have high-quality, free public educational institutions, then what have we become? We become a nation where we have some kids prepared for the world ahead of them, depending on what they take in college, how they have been prepared prior to that, the kind of parenting they've had. And unfortunately, the majority of those children are not aware. So those are the problems we face. So we're going to begin today's program with a commentary. And this commentary is going to deal with the dictatorship that exists in our society disguised as a democracy. And I want to share this. I'm going to be sharing thoughts from John Whitehead, who I highly respect, a constitutional lawyer, and what I have observed recently. And that's important, that I'm trying to speak on behalf of many of you. At the beginning of Pacifica Foundation, the founder of Pacifica was a person who believed in the foundation being a voice for the voiceless. And for a while it was. Today, unfortunately, in many cases, it's not. There's censorship, there's rancor, there's internecine conflict, there's power grabbing. As a result, their audience is completely dissipated. On the other hand, people who engage in censorship, such as Mark Zuckerberg, a Facebook founder, and Google founders, and Twitter, and other accounts, and especially Wikipedia, their platforms are used specifically to target those whose opinions they do not like. Even if those opinions represent no threat to people, but actually are liberating when they're telling the truth that we need to hear. So I believe that we should be able to engage in open, civil, and meaningful conversation and dialogue. But we don't seem to do that today. There was a professor, his name was Neil Potsman, and he wrote a very important book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, Discourse in the Age of Show Business. And here's what he said. He said, when a population becomes distracted by trivia, when cultural life is redefined as a perpetual round of entertainments, when serious public conversation becomes a form of baby talk, when, in short, a people become an audience and their public business a vaudeville act, then a nation finds itself at risk. A cultural death is a clear possibility. And I believe that when you look at all of our reality programs, when you look at what passes for serious journalism, what passes for serious legislation on important issues, we've already arrived there. Now, hopefully, a little later on in our program, we will have a person on the air who can discuss that in depth. And that person is a person who is one of the most outspoken, honest lawyers in the world. His name is Christopher Black. And I've asked him also to contribute to today's program because I want to go back and I'm going to revisit the truth about Rwanda. Because I believe everything that I have been told and believed and everything that was printed in the media is a lie. I also came across a story how about the president of Yugoslavia was found innocent of the charges of crimes against humanity. Why didn't we know that? That was in Yugoslavia. Why does the United States thirst for regime change? Well, Christopher Black will share those insights with us. But before we go to Christopher Black, I just want you to think on something and see if it's reasonable. If it's not reasonable, don't use it. If it is, then hopefully you will spend a little time meditating on its significance. Because what characterizes American government today, in my opinion, is not so much dysfunctional politics as it is ruthlessly contrived governance carried out behind the entertaining, distracting, and disingenuous curtain of political theater. And what political theater it is, diabolically Shakespearean at times, full of sound and fury, yet in the end signifying nothing. played out on the national stage and eagerly broadcast to a captive audience by media sponsors, this farcical exercise in political theater can, at times, seem riveting, life-changing, and suspenseful, even for those who know better. Did you know, for example, that Monsanto is doing a massive advertising campaign for its Roundup herbicide on MSNBC? Where are their censors? Where are their people guarding the gates to say, this has been proven to be a known carcinogen? You've lost 3 straight lawsuits. You have 13,400 lawsuits coming at you. We would be remiss in our responsibility to protect the public if we allowed you to advertise. But no, it doesn't stop there, does it? Nor does it stop when we are told that the best form of cancer therapy is chemotherapy and radiation. But what if it isn't? Are you aware that oncologists are allowed by law to buy a product at wholesale, chemotherapy drugs, sell it to you at retail, get your insurance coverage for part of it and cash out of your pocket for the rest, and never have to divulge that? How does that taint their idea that maybe you should try another type of therapy? Or no therapy? Maybe change your lifestyle. So you see, everywhere we're playing out, every institution, in my opinion, has betrayed us. We're told by Samuel Jackson that every day, every hour of a day, when we make a payment, we're guaranteed a 2% return on our Capital One card. Why couldn't he say this? Every day, every time you use a credit card, and we're assuming you're using a credit card because you don't have disposable cash, you're being charged 16% interest, and if you miss a payment or can't make the full payment, they're going to increase that interest up to 58%. But you won't hear that ad, will you? And we're told by the Obama administration at the end of the Bush administration that the bailout had to come to Wall Street, yet it has a separate economy. The money made on Wall Street stays on Wall Street, stays with those who gambled and won. When they make a mistake, they're bailed out. When you and I make a mistake, too bad, learn your lessons. When they decry socialism for the poor and cut back on food stamps and try to cut back on Medicaid and Medicare, the two systems that help the poor, and our Social Security, which they've been borrowing over $2.3 trillion from that and saying it's fine, it's not fine. And yet they want welfare, they want socialization for their losses, but they use their profits to themselves and don't share it. And not a single person's home was held from foreclosure because of the benevolence of the lending industry, the mortgage people. No, they wanted your home back, and the fact you were homeless was irrelevant. 7.5 million Americans lost their homes. Who was there to advocate for them? No one. So you see, it's all being played out. Week after week, the script changes. If Donald Trump tweets, suddenly the stock market goes down. If it's something that discourages trade. Congress hearings on Robert Mueller's Russian probe, which is a total farce. The military's endless war drums. The over-widening and unwieldy field of candidates. And how many of those candidates have said, let us examine the role of the United States in Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Let us examine in Yemen how a nation of 29 million, 19 million are at risk of dying. Hundreds of thousands have died. And we participate that. Our tax dollars goes to fund that. And when did you hear any of the 200,000 military contractors, any of the thousands of lobbyists for those contractors, any of the legislators who accepted money from those manufacturers of weapons, when did they say, yes, that's a legitimate investigation? None? Never? So what does that tell you about who controls, who owns the loyalty of those candidates? Have you heard any of those candidates say, let's get rid of the Glass-Steagall Act or bring it back? Let's get rid of Citizens United. We can afford and we can actually save money by having universal health care if we take the profit out of it. No, we should close down the military-industrial complex. We don't need it the way it's been metastasizing. No, no, we should take money out of politics. Absolutely not, they say. The players come and go. The protagonist and antagonist trade places, and the audience members are quick to forget past mistakes and move on to the next spectacle and debacle. All the while, a different kind of drama is unfolding in the dark backstage, hidden away from view by the heavy curtain, the elaborate stage sets, colored lights, and parading actors. Such that it is the realm of political theater, with all of its drama and vitriol and scripted theatrics, is what passes for transparent government today, with elected officials entrusted to act in the best interests of their constituents, routinely performing for their audiences and playing up to the cameras, while doing nothing to move the country forward. We say, great, look at the economy, it's booming. Part of it is, yes, unemployment's the lowest in over 40 years. Officially, that's true. And yet Democrat and Republican will stop the analysis at the macro element. Let's look carefully. Big Pharma is making record-breaking profits more than any other industry. As a result, it's a major part of gross domestic product. Wall Street is making profits. It's there. The military-industrial contract with ever-expanding wars and national security threats, it makes profits. The oil industry and gas hydrofracking making profits. So about six areas of our economy are doing great. All the while, we have 50 million Americans who don't have $500 to their name but have a lot of debt. We have 100 million Americans who are at poverty door. We have senior citizens who cannot retire. And the real unemployment number, the real unemployment number, and any economist who was worth his salt would look for that truth, is that 102 million Americans today who did work aren't working, and they're excluded from all the unemployment statistics. Well, how can you have over one-third of all adults in America unemployed, and they don't count in any statistic? Because if you counted them, you're up to 27% unemployment. If you look at the real economy, we're failing miserably over half of the American population. But let's not deal with truth. Let's stay focused upon illusion. It's the oldest con game in the books, the magician's sleight of hand that keeps you focused on the shell game in front of you, while your wallet and your psyche and your beliefs are being picked clean by the ruffians in your midst. Indeed, while mainstream America has been fixated on the drama-filled reality show being televised from the White House, the American police state has moved steadily forward. Many times on this program, I've told you my concern that we are in not just as what was called an inverted totalitarianism, Sheldon Wolin's concept, but we are in a rampant fascistic police state today. Yeah. Did I miss something? Isn't that the backdrop of a government surveillance of everyone all the time? Militarized police, SWAT team raids, asset forfeiture, eminent domain, overcriminalization, armed surveillance drones, whole body scanners, stop and frisk searches, roving VIPR raids, and the like, all of which have been sanctioned by Congress, the White House, the courts, the Supreme Court. Our constitutional freedoms have been steadily chipped away and undermined, eroded, whittled down, and generally discarded. All the while, nobody paid attention. Our losses are mounting with every passing day. Free speech, the right to protest, the right to challenge government wrongdoing, due process, a presumption of innocence, the right to self-defense, accountability, transparency in government, privacy, press, sovereignty, assembly, bodily integrity, representative government, all these and more have become casualties in the government war on the American people. And the hypocrisy of the left is palpable. My body, my choice. Okay, good. Unless it's a vaccine. Oh, no, then it's not your choice. It's not your body. It's the government's body. How dare you? You're a risk to everyone else. Wow. Could you become more inane? The American public have been treated like enemy combatants, to be spied on, tracked, scanned, frisked, searched, subjected to all manner of intrusions, intimidated, invaded, raided, manhandled, censored, silenced, shot at, locked up, and denied due process. And none of these dangers have dissipated. They have been merely disappeared from our television news. No one at MSNBC will ever discuss these, nor at the other networks, nor in Time, nor CNN, because they are the supplicants, the servants, the handmaidens, the lapdogs, the propagandists for those in power. The new boss has proven to be the same as the old boss, and the American people, the perpetual underclass in America, has allowed itself to be so distracted and divided that they have failed to notice the building blocks of tyranny being laid down right under their noses by the architects of the deep state. Frankly, it really doesn't matter what you call the old new, the deep state, the controllers, the masterminds, the shadow government, the police state, the surveillance state, the military-industrial complex. So long as you understand that no matter who occupies the White House, it is a profit-driven, unelected bureaucracy that is actually calling the shots. In the interest of liberty and truth, I'll give you just a few examples before we go to my guest who's standing by. A is for the American police state. A police state is characterized by bureaucracy, secrecy, perpetual wars, and nation of suspects, militarization, surveillance, weaponization of all politics, widespread police presence, and a citizenry with little recourse against the police actions. B is for our battered Bill of Rights. In the cop culture that is America today, where you can be kicked, punched, tasered, shot, intimidated, harassed, stripped, searched, brutalized, terrorized, wrongfully arrested, and even killed by a police officer, all while they're completely exonerated in 90% of the cases, and that officer is rarely held accountable for violating your rights, the Bill of Rights doesn't amount to much. C is for civil asset forfeiture. This government scheme is to deprive Americans of their liberties, namely the right to property, is being carried out under the guise of civil asset forfeiture, a government practice wherein government agents, usually the police, seize private property because they suspect you may have been connected with a criminal activity. Of course, 99% of it never is. And they know that. D is for drones. It's estimated there are 30,000 drones airborne this year and next year. It's an $80 billion industry. And they're there to look at people. They're equipped with lasers, tasers, scanning devices, and weaponized. E is for the electronic concentration camp that we're all now a part of. In the electronic concentration camp, as I've dubbed the surveillance state, all aspects of your life are policed by government agents, and all citizens are suspects. Their activities monitored and regulated, their movements tracked, their communications spied upon, and their lives, liberties, and pursuit of happiness dependent upon if the government wants you to have any such liberties. So that is what we're dealing with. Now, on an upcoming program, I'll deal with F, fascism, a truly interesting and unique phenomenon today. In fact, it was Princeton University as well as Northwestern University concluded that the United States does not represent the majority of American citizens. Instead, the study found that the government is ruled by the rich and powerful, the so-called economic elite. Moreover, the researchers concluded that the policies enacted by this government elite nearly always favor special interests and lobbying groups. In other words, we are being ruled by an oligarchy disguised as a democracy and arguably on our way towards fascism, a form of government where private corporate interests rule. Money calls the shots and the people are seen as mere economic units. But I can go through the entire alphabet. And I will on an upcoming program. But now, we're going to go to our guest who is standing by for this segment of our program. And he is on the line now from Toronto. He is Christopher Black. And Christopher is a Canadian attorney activist. He is a journalist. He has worked with the famous Toronto Black activist attorney Charles Roach on criminal cases before entering international criminal law. So he has a long background. He is also the author of an important work, How the U.S. Creates a S-Hole Nations. His website is christopher-black.com. Nice to have you with us today, Christopher.
Oh, it's great to be back and just talk with you again. It's very interesting to listen to you, I must say.
Christopher, I'd like to take our audience on a journey, and you're going to guide us. We have been led to believe one story about Rwanda, and I'm going to revisit it for a simple reason, because history was written by those in power, the Clintons and their permanent stay-behinds in government and in academia and in social media and in mainstream media. So we have all been taught what now is viewed as lies. So take us step by step through the Hutu-Tutsi feud, which existed since colonial times, and what was the primary motivation for the United States and its European allies to want to initiate a regime change in Rwanda, because that's what it was.
Right.
So start there and take us on what really happened in Rwanda versus what we were told happened. The floor is yours.
Okay. Like you, when I got into this, I believed everything I read in the papers. When the events in Rwanda in 1994 took place, I watched it on the television and read it in the papers, and it seemed like savagery on a vast scale with no rhyme or reason. And it was very racist because it was portrayed as African savagery and tribes fighting tribes, and there was no reason given for it, no explanation, no context given to you. But when I was asked to defend a Rwandan general who was the head of the national police, the gendarmerie, I was reluctant at first to take it because I didn't want to go to Africa and I didn't want to leave Toronto, and I had a busy practice there. But I finally did take a case there and I agreed to defend this general. And over the next 15 years, though they told me it would be a two-year trial, the next 15 years, I and other defense lawyers there began to investigate what really happened. And we found out that what really happened was the exact opposite of what you've been told has happened. And the reason for the main reason for the war in Rwanda is the quest by the United States and its other Western allies to break up the Congo into pieces. And the Americans wanted to break it up into three pieces. And in order to gain control of Katanga, which is the eastern mineral-rich provinces of the Congo, which are vast. And that was what the war of Rwanda was all about. Secondarily, it was a war between France and the United States for control of Central Africa and all those mineral resources, and the French lost. But that was the impetus of the war. Going back to the history of the context of that war, Rwanda is a very, very small country, landlocked country in between Tanzania, Kenya, and Rwanda and Burundi, in the middle of East Africa. It's in the what they call the Great Lakes region, where Lake Victoria is, and some other lakes. And up until 1990, it was considered, as Bill Clinton once said, the Switzerland of Africa. And why? Because even though it was one of the poorest countries in Africa, because it had almost no resources, depended on agriculture only, or mainly for its income, coffee and tea plantations were its main exports. It was a semi-socialist country with one-party state, like many African countries at that time, and has succeeded in bringing this poor country up to a certain level, a standard of living, which was considered remarkable, even in Africa. That was all destroyed in 1990. How did that happen? For that, we go back to, say, 1960. Between 1890 and 1960, Rwanda was taken over by first the Germans before World War I as a colony. When the Germans lost it in World War I, it was assigned to Belgium as a protectorate or a trust territory. So Belgium then ran Rwanda up until 1960. In Rwanda, there are three peoples. There are the Twa, which sometimes are called pygmies, bush hunter-gatherers. There are the Hutu, who came in many, many centuries ago, Bantu from West Africa, and are farmers, agriculturalists, and the minority people called the Tutsi, who came from Sudan area, Egypt, and down in the 1700s, 1600s. Nobody's quite sure on that. And entered Rwanda and took over rulership of the country because they were a warrior people. They were a cattle breeding people. And they took over control of the country, and their aristocracy and monarchy controlled the Hutus. And they ended up producing a serf state in which the Hutus were serfs to the Tutsi. And they were required, like as it used to be in Russia before in the Tsarist times, they were required to give a corvée, that is, to work for free a certain number of days for the Tutsi overlords. They could not take part in government. They could not take part in police or army or military. They could not take part in education. They were not allowed to go to schools. They couldn't be priests. They couldn't be educated. They were reduced to almost, not quite slavery, but we'd call it serfdom. In 1960, with the wave of liberation movements supported by the USSR and Britain and China in particular, which led to the breakup of the British Empire and its loss of colonies there, and the Portuguese colonies and so on, there was a movement for democracy in Rwanda, and some of the Hutus who had been allowed to go to certain seminaries and had become educated put out a manifesto called the Hutu Manifesto, which, if you read it, reads like a manifesto put out during the French Revolution or the American Revolutionary Wars. It was the demand for democracy, for the right to unions, for women's rights, for the right to education, the right to life, the right to work, the right to free medical care, and so on and so forth. So they're basically fundamental rights everybody recognizes as necessary today, and that's what the Hutu Manifesto was all about. This led to Belgium, funny enough, but Belgium began pushing for a democratic reform of the Rwandan aristocracy. And they set up elections in 1960 to be held, where the people could freely vote to who their leadership would be. The Tutsis, who were the aristocracy and the Tutsi king, opposed this, but they were forced to go through with it under international pressure. And in the elections, the Hutus won all the elections, of course, because they were 85% of the population. They took over the mayorships and the town councils and the government. The Tutsi aristocracy, some elements of it, opposed this and attacked certain Hutus and killed them. There were reprisals by Hutus against Tutsis at that time. The Belgians came back in, police forces, the UN sent people in and calmed things down. And those Tutsis that refused to accept this democratic change left the country and went to mainly Uganda, some to Tanzania and the surrounding countries, but most of them went to Uganda. And they vowed never to come back unless they could rule the country again completely by themselves, which is what they finally did. Between 1963 and mid-70s, there were several raids by these Tutsi forces from Uganda into Rwanda, causing mayhem. But again, UN forces were sent in and kicked them out, or the government was able to kick them out. But in every report, the UN blames the Tutsis for murdering people. And they're, in fact, acting like the Contras did in Nicaragua. After 1975, things calmed down and the country began to develop. There was peace and harmony up until 1990. After that, there was no real... The Tutsis that remained, which were the majority, stayed in Rwanda, and the relations between Tutsis and Hutus were fairly good. There was a mainly Hutu government because the majority of people were Hutu, but there were Tutsi representatives in the government, there were Tutsi officials, and the Tutsis still controlled most of the elements of the economy because before the Republic was declared in 1960, the Tutsis controlled all the economy. They controlled the contracting companies, export-import companies, teak plantations, coffee plantations, and they remained in control of those elements of the economy throughout the period we're talking about. So they were never oppressed, as the diaspora Tutsis always claimed, and they enjoyed the same rights as most Hutus. And we can go into a lot of detail about that. Spent hours talking about these details, but we get lost in too many details. Anyway, so Rwanda, Bill Clinton visited there, and I think in the 80s, and called it the Switzerland of Africa, and it was a remarkable thing to do. Rwanda at that time was receiving aid from all sorts of countries, from East Germany, from North Korea, from Russia, from China, but also from West Germany, France, Italy, UK, US, Israel, and so on. So it was very eclectic in who it took aid from. In the late 1980s, the Tutsi diaspora, especially in the United States and California, began openly talking about taking back power in Rwanda, that a change needed to go back and crush these Hutus who were oppressing them. It got a lot of sympathy from human rights groups in the United States and in Belgium especially, where they were also strong. They formed an opposition party and began issuing political statements declaring that they should be ruling Rwanda and liberate the country once more. The main excuse that they used, or pretext they used for this maneuver, was that the Tutsis were not allowed to return to Rwanda, which is never true. Individual Tutsis and families always were able to return to Rwanda, and many did. But now the diaspora, who had left into Uganda in 1960, were about 500,000 people now living in Uganda, and the government was not able to absorb so many people en masse at one time. That was the problem. So in 1989-1990, negotiations took place between the Rwandan government, the Ugandan government, where most of these Tutsis resided, the United States, the UN Human Rights, or the Human Rights and the United Nations Refugee Organization, were involved in negotiations. And it was finally agreed in 1990, spring and summer of 1990, that the Rwanda government would take back everybody en masse at once, if that was what was needed. And they said, okay, but you have to send a team here from Uganda to discuss with us the logistics of how this is going to happen, because these people are going to come with cattle. Rwanda is a small country. Already the whole land's occupied. Where are we going to put them? Where are we going to house them? How are we going to provide a living for them? And what are they going to do here? So they agreed, the Tutsis in Uganda, to send a team. They never did. What they did on the day that they were supposed to send a team, they instead sent an invading army. Now, the Tutsis in Uganda, who made the invasion, had served, many of them had joined the Ugandan National Army. They fought against Obote, the socialist Obote, with I've forgotten his name now, the man before Museveni. Anyway, they fought against Obote twice, and then ended up joining Museveni's forces. So many of the Tutsi forces were members of the Ugandan army. But they were the military wing of the political elements in the United States and Belgium, which wanted to come back into and seize power in Rwanda. So it was quite clear that they had the backing of the United States and the UK when this invasion took place, because when they invaded on October 1st, 1990, they attacked many villages and killed quite a number of Hutu civilians. For about 2 weeks, they penetrated the country, but then they were forced back by the Rwandan army and a Congolese battalion. But during that attack, the president of Rwanda, Mr. Habyarimana, had been invited to Washington to take part in some talks about some other issues. When the invasion took place, Bill Clinton offered to him refuge in the United States if he would cede power. So it's quite clear that he was invited to Washington to be out of the way when the invasion took place, so that they would not be organized. And he was then supposed to collapse, accept the offer, and be left in exile in the United States. But President Habyarimana refused to take that offer and immediately flew back home and did organize a resistance, which ended up crushing this invasion. Now, every member of the invading army, we found out, had Ugandan army identity cards. They used Ugandan army equipment, Ugandan army artillery and weapons. So they were really the Ugandan army invading under the guise of what they call the Rwanda Patriotic Front, who is what we keep running into now. The Rwanda Patriotic Front is the political wing of the movement of the Tutsi aristocrats to take power in Rwanda, who now rule Rwanda today. Their military wing was called the Rwanda Patriotic Army, or the RPA. Since the invasion of October 1st collapsed, they then decided to engage in what they called guerrilla warfare, which was in fact nothing more than terrorism. They used exactly the same tactics that you saw in the 1980s in Nicaragua, when the Contras were going into Nicaragua and murdering doctors and nurses and school teachers and creating mayhem everywhere they could to destabilize the country. And that's exactly what happened for the next 4 years. Between 1990 and April 1994, when the events the public is aware of happened, in those 4 years, there were continual raids by the RPF forces into Rwanda. They killed hundreds of thousands of Hutus in very horrible ways you don't want to discuss on the air. And over time, they forced out 1 million Hutu peasant farmers from the north of the country, which was the breadbasket of the country where most of the grain and other food crops were grown, into the area of the capital city, Kigali, which had a population of about 250,000. So now we have, over a three-year period, 1 million people moving into the city and surrounding the city in refugee camps. At the same time, the British and the Americans fiddled with the coffee and tea prices on the export markets, and the price for coffee and tea collapsed. So they had no revenue to then pay the bureaucracy and pay teachers and doctors and the army and so on. It caused chaos. It caused a lot of resentment among different sectors of society. There were continual bombings. The RPF laid mines, blew up civilian buses, assassinated people. During this period, there were several ceasefires arranged. In each case, the RPF forces violated the ceasefire. During the same period, while under pressure, the one-party state run by President Habyarimana, which is a semi-socialist state and a semi-socialist party, the MRND, the Movement for the Republican Development of the Country, he agreed under French pressure and American pressure to democratize, that is, to agree to have multi-party democracy, that is, Western-style democracy. And so in 1991-92, they changed the constitution to allow many more parties to take part. And about 15 different parties sprang up. They called themselves the Liberal Parties, Progressive Party, Labor Party, so on and so forth. Most of them, it turned out, from the evidence, turned out to be front parties for the RPF and were controlled by the RPF or proxies for them, and even in the Hutu community. Because even in the Hutu community, there were people who didn't like the president for various reasons. There were disputes between the northern and southern Hutus and so on. There was all sorts of internal dynamics going on. So even under inner war and under pressure, President Habyarimana changed the entire constitution, allowed multi-party democracy. There was complete freedom of the press. And yet the war continued. In 1993, there was a major violation of a peace agreement when the RPF forces attacked the town of Ruwengeri, which is in the north of the country. They occupied the town for about 2 weeks before they were pushed out by the army. In those 2 weeks, they killed 40,000 Hutus, civilians, 40,000. The soldiers gave us testimony at the Rwanda Tribunal of finding civilians mangled in all sorts of horrible ways. And they just deliberately killed as many people as they could. And why? Because they wanted to terrorize the people to force them out of the area. They wanted that land empty so that their people could come in from Uganda and occupy it. And you see the same thing going on in Israel and Palestine and other places like that. So in 1993, after that major violation and major massacre of Hutus by the Tutsis, the UN decided to send in a peacekeeping force. So a peacekeeping force was arranged and sent in around September 1993. And the general in charge of that was a Canadian general named Romeo Dallaire. But he was not the head of the entire peacekeeping organization. He had a political boss named Jacques Roger Bobo, who he had to nominally report to but never did. And the peacekeeping force was made up of several battalions. One, the main battalion, the heaviest one, was Belgians. There was Canadian staff, headquarters staff. There were Bangladeshis and some other minor groups involved. But the Belgians were the main ones. from 1990, so they were supposed to keep the peace between the two warring factions, well, not factions, between the government and the invading forces. Because in when the UN decided to send this group in, they forced a conclusion of a peace agreement called the Arusha Accords, in which both sides agreed to hold elections within 9 months, and then they would abide by whatever those elections produced. The Arusha Accords were considered a sellout by many Hutus and the army, because it gave, at the conclusion of the elections, it gave half the officer class to the Tutsi forces, even though they represented only 15% of the population at most. And there were other things like that which caused a lot of resentment. But there were concessions, major concessions made by the government to come to some peaceful settlement of this whole problem. And the government even accepted to call these Tutsis who were invading from Uganda rebels. That is, that they were almost like considered to be local people, though they weren't. Now, between October 93 and April 94, the UN peacekeeping force, which was supposed to keep everybody neutral and to keep the forces from fighting each other or preparing for any more fighting, did not do that job. In fact, they spent the entire time helping the RPF invading forces prepare for a final offensive, which took place in April. They allowed them to bring in weapons from Uganda, like heavy weapons, heavy artillery, Katyusha rocket launches, heavy machine guns were being smuggled in on a daily basis. And we found reports from the UN, which we were given what they call situation reports from military observers sent out by Dallaire himself to observe the movements of different troop formations, and they were reporting that the RPF was bringing in men and materiel all the time. And Dallaire kept his secret from the government when he was supposed to report it. And he actively acted as a spy and reported back government information to the RPF invading forces. Now, the RPF knew, and everybody knew, that they could never win the elections because at most they could only get the Tutsi vote. There were a few Hutus might support allied parties, but they were going to lose the elections and therefore lose everything they've been fighting for. So on April 6, 1994, which is what most people are told about these days, they acted to sabotage the Arusha Accords and try and take power, complete power by themselves and not wait for elections. So on that night, on the night of the April 6th, the president of Rwanda, who had been lured to a meeting in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania by President Museveni helping the RPF, he lured him to a meeting in Dar es Salaam, never knew what the meeting was about. It turned out to be about nothing. But he went, the president of Burundi went, president of Tanzania was there. The recounts of the meeting say they mulled around, not knowing why they were there, and decided to fly back. And it turns out that the reason they lured them there was that they could shoot them down on the way back. So when the president of Rwanda flew back on his private jet with the president of Burundi, the plane was shot down over Kigali, and the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi were both killed, both Hutus. And the army chief of staff was killed on that plane, and 20 other people. The flight crew were all French, about three officers on that plane, pilot and co-pilot and a navigator or an engineer. As soon as the plane went down, the RPF forces launched a final offensive across the country that same night. Now, the story you get on the press is that a genocide was started that night. That's not true. There was nothing happening on the government side that night. They were in complete panic. They had no idea what was happening. And when the plane went down, they called a meeting that night, the Army Chief of Staff and my general I defended was in that meeting. They called a meeting of all the officer staff to figure out what to do and how to keep the peace. They even asked General Dallaire and a Colonel Marshall, who was the Belgian colonel in charge of the Belgian contingent, to come to this meeting. And they asked them for their advice. What can we do? We know very well who shot down the plane. What can we do? We don't want a war. We're not prepared for a war. Well, that went nowhere, and the RPF continued their attack that same night. The same night, they attacked the presidential guard barracks. We have reports from Belgian intelligence where they were told, the Belgian forces were told to stand down, that they can expect a movement of RPF forces across their line to attack the Rwandan presidential guard barracks and not to interfere, in which that's what happened. But that's never said in the press. So there was fighting that night against the government, and the forces in the north of the country, north of the capital, also began movements that night, attacking outposts. On the morning of the 7th, the RPF forces began massacring Hutus in a region, a district of Kigali called Remera, and that they just massacred any Hutu they saw to drive them out of the area. They attacked the army military police camp and killed almost everybody. They killed 500 military police, so there was no military police presence in the Rwandan army after that. And they attacked all the gendarme camps, that is, the national police camps. They were subject from then on to constant bombardment by Katusha rockets, heavy machine guns. And the Belgians, who had occupied three of the hills around Kigali, because it's set in a valley underneath three hills, the Belgians had occupied those hills for security. They handed those their emplacements over to the RPF forces, and so they had complete command of everything below them, and they began strafing the streets continuously. Now, and so for the next 12 weeks, this war lasts. Within 3 days, 4 days, the Rwandan army is in such a state that they actually offer to surrender. On April 12th, they contact Dallaire and said, we're willing to surrender if the RPF forces and your forces, UN forces, combine with us to go on the streets to stop those bandits and other people who are taking retaliation against everybody and stop the killing. Because what was happening was, in Kigali, because of the police being under attack and there was a power vacuum, each district began setting up barricades to protect that district. So if you came into that district, nobody knew who you were. They assumed you were a Tutsi fighter from the RPF trying to kill them, so they would kill you if you had no ID. And many people did not have ID. And many innocent Tutsis and Hutus were killed this way. But you have to understand that these people had been hearing from the refugees who'd be driven from the north all sorts of horrible stories of what the RPF Tutsis were doing to people when they came. So there was a whole psychological
Chris, we don't have a lot of time left, so I'd like to ask you some specific questions, and if you give us summary answers, please. Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton, we were told that it did not rise to the level of genocide, so that's why America did not intervene. Mm-hmm. What was the actual role of Bill and Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright in this genocide?
Well, the word genocide is a problem for me, because what genocide are you talking about?
The murder. Let's not get distracted.
So now, why did Bill Clinton refuse to use the word genocide initially, but did later? Because they wanted the RPF to be able to move and take over the country. If they had declared it a genocide on the first couple of days, then the UN would have been required to send in more people, and the RPF would have been stopped in their offensive. In fact, the Rwandan government asked the UN to send in 5,000 more men to keep the peace, but the United States kept that request off the agenda at the Security Council. So that's why
that would have been Madeleine Albright.
They refused to call it a genocide.
What role, what role, if any, did Bill and Hillary Clinton play in this crisis, this tragedy?
Well, Bill Clinton gave the instructions, to not label it a genocide so the RPF could go ahead with their offensive. They kept it. They kept the Rwandan government request for more UN force to come in off the Security Council agenda. They had forces placed in Burundi to help the RPF. They had a battalion of U.S. Army Rangers there, which were used. And we found out from the evidence that the Americans were in Kigali's, American soldiers were seen at Kigali's headquarters just before the attack was launched. U.S. C-130 Hercules were observed in the days after April 6th, dropping men and supplies to the RPF forces. So it's quite clear the Americans were involved on the ground.
That meant the CIA would have been involved.
Pardon me?
What role did the CIA play in this?
A lawyer named Michael Horrigan, who was an investigator for the prosecutor, the Rwanda tribunal, was asked to find out who shot down the plane, and he reported back that he found out who shot down the plane and that the CIA was involved in shooting down the plane. That the missiles that were used to shoot down the plane were assembled in a hangar, which was rented by the CIA, known to be a CIA operation. So the CIA is implicated in the assassination.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, Bill and Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright were responsible for the crisis, whatever you wish to call it. I'm calling it genocide. I don't give a damn what anyone else calls it.
Okay.
And they caused it. The United States government had boots on the ground. The CIA was complicit. Why didn't the New York Times, why didn't any media in the United States, not a single media, cover the truth and find the truth?
Because then they would not have been able to take over Rwanda and place their puppet in charge, Mr. Kagame, who was still there, who was then used with Museveni to invade the Congo, to break up the Congo, so that the companies of Canadian, American, Israeli, British, and Australian mining companies could go in there and exploit Congo almost completely freely. That's why.
So at the end of the day, nearly over 900,000 people died, mainly Hutu, but also some Tutsi, because of the unmitigated greed of wanting mineral resources out of the Congo, and this was the most expeditious way of doing it?
Essentially that's what it's all about. The Rwanda was not important itself. It was the doorway into the Congo, and the United States had asked Rwanda before if they could use Rwanda to invade Congo to kick out Mobutu, because Mobutu had shifted from being an American puppet to dealing with the Chinese, which the Americans did not like. So they wanted him out, and they wanted to take over Congo completely. So Rwanda was the doorway in, and so they had to install their own puppet in charge in Rwanda in order to have the follow-up invasions of Congo in 1996, 1997, in which maybe 10 million people have been killed.
And
nobody knows how many people were killed in Rwanda. Nobody knows.
Okay. As an attorney, as someone who has studied this carefully, who's been in the courts, who was in the International Criminal Court system defending Rwanda's general and found him completely innocent of war crimes at the Rwanda War Crimes Tribunal, you know that there is no statute of limitation on crimes against humanity. Why don't you or others that you could get bring charges against those who you can document, like Bill and Hillary Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and the Canadian general and others, for crimes against humanity?
Well, the defense consistently, many defense lawyers, not only myself, called for them to be charged by the prosecutor of the Rwanda tribunal. But, of course, the prosecution was run by the American intelligence services and the Army. The first person I met when I got there was an American Air Force colonel. She was in charge of the prosecutions at the Rwanda tribunal. So everything was controlled by them. The ICC has no jurisdiction going back that far. And there's no other tribunal before which they can be charged, except maybe the people of the United States can have their own people's tribunal at some point. But there is no other way of charging them.
Ramsey Clark is head of that. Okay, well, at least today on this program, you're telling the world the truth. And since it's the number one progressive radio program in the world, you have a substantial audience. This information will get out, and it's one more mark and an awful lot of marks against the Clintons. So at least now we know the truth about what happened in Rwanda And everyone in the media is complicit because they chose to support the Clintons as they did in this election. Their biases are obvious, but when you're biased for someone who's committed genocide, then no one should support that media in the future. Christopher Black, thank you very much for coming on and telling us what we needed to hear, this horror story. And we're regurgitating it up because everything we've been told was a lie. So now we know the truth. Thank you very much for being on today. For more information, go to christopher-black.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, pick it light. Pick it sides. Don't punish me sister. With brutality sister. Talk to me sister. So you can see sister. Oh.